From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Star Wars, The Force Awakens premiered on Friday, but even before it hit the screens, it was destined for the best-selling opening weekend of all time. Advanced ticket sales for the latest in the epic saga topped $200 million, and it's sure to make hundreds of millions more in the coming weeks. In the next hour, then, we'll be joined by two of the major behind-the-camera players in this installment of the series. Later this hour, we'll hear from the musical force behind The Force, John Williams, who has scored every Star Wars film since the franchise first started back in 1977 and is without a doubt the most successful Hollywood composer of all time. But first, please be joined by the director, producer, and co-writer of The Force Awakens, J.J. Abrams, one of the most powerful names in the business. He is the founder and president of Bad Robot Productions and has been the creative force behind such hit TV shows as Lost, Alias, and Fringe. He also breathed new life into the Mission Impossible and Star Trek franchises for the big screen, so it's easy to see why he was entrusted by Disney to take the reins of the seventh installment of the Star Wars saga. Before we start our conversation with Mr. Abrams, a clip from Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
We cannot run them!
We might! In that quad jumper!
Hey, we need a pilot!
We've got one!
You!
Let me just jump into this right quick and get it out of the way. Can I just tell you, I haven't seen you in a little while, I guess.
Yeah.
But I was so pleased and moved by your handwritten note to put this controversy, just to smash down this controversy.
Controversy.
Yeah. What do you make of this? You got a black guy in the film, and some people lose their freaking minds.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
It's and it's sad. Yeah. And it's hurtful, and it's... something that I just wanted, I couldn't just not say anything. The truth is, it was really important to me that we show, we have a cast that reflects how the world looks. Mm-hmm. And it was, there are a lot of things that fall into the category of nothing was more important to me than, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, it's character, it's comedy, it's adventure, it's romance, it's the plot, it's the design, all that stuff. But one of the things was that the movie looked like the world. So we cast this movie, and we have people in this movie, Oscar Isaac and John Boyega, mm-hmm. and we have this wonderful young actress, Daisy Ridley, in a central role. This was just what was important and what felt right. And so for there to be any controversy, yeah. that a female is in a leading role, that a black man is a leading character, that a Latino actor is, it's like, yeah. These are not controversies. It's nearly 2016 is what it is. You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Since you mentioned female, it seems to me, and I haven't seen this thing from start to finish, just bits and pieces,
mm-hmm.
But it seems to me, which doesn't surprise me knowing you, that you have also made an attempt in that category of things that are really important to me to make this a movie that everybody can enjoy, which is to say race, color, creed, gender.
Sure.
This movie clearly is a boys' movie. Guys love Star Wars.
Well, it's funny. I said that, and yeah. I got into trouble at home because my wife and daughter are enormous fans of Star Wars, and I said this somewhere, and I was an idiot, and I was tired. I'd probably been in too many marketing meetings, but the truth is that because... whether it's through the toys or the, you know, seeing ads where mm-hmm. only boys' action figures are, Star Wars has always been for everyone. And what George Lucas created with Leia and Padme, these characters that are wonderful characters, I am well aware that we have a big and passionate female fan base. Mm-hmm. I'm thrilled about that. What I meant to say was that this movie has at its heart, you know, females that are human and not human, good guys and bad guys. There are a lot of women, females, in this movie, and it's as important to me that girls and young women see themselves not just as a one of a multitude of characters and maybe one of the only women, mm-hmm. but one of many women. Mm-hmm. And so it's a movie that I hope girls and women love as much as they love the prior Star Wars movies, yeah. and maybe even see themselves in a different way in this one.
Yeah. So I was laughing and talking to a friend of mine about you the other day, and I said, I'm going to have to paint an S on JJ's chest, not for Superman, although you have been superhuman to pull this thing off, but the S for, like, sequel man.
It's like, you have done a number of these.
Well,
so what were you thinking when you decided, I'm going to take on yet another? Star Trek wasn't enough. Mission Impossible wasn't enough.
Right, the S could also stand for shameful, because the truth is, you're not wrong. And it's not anything that I ever set out to do or expected to. And the fact is, when Kathy Kennedy asked if I'd be interested in doing Star Wars, my first reaction was, I can't. Mm-hmm. I've done these sequels. I can't do that again. And I also love it so much. And Katie and I had plans to take our kids away for a while. There are all sorts of great reasons why the answer was no. And then I met with Kathy Kennedy, who's just one of the great producers of all time.
No doubt.
And we just started talking about what this movie could be. And I just found myself so desperate to do this movie, and I had no idea.
What pulled you in? When you thought the answer might be no, what pulled you in?
The thing that pulled me in the most, I think, was just starting to talk about who these new young characters would be living in the Star Wars universe. Because this is like, 35 years after the last story. Mm-hmm. So there would be a group of, people, a group of young people that wouldn't have existed, wouldn't know necessarily the history of what we know. And it just felt to me like it was a very strange feeling. It wasn't even a story, but it was a feeling that there was a story and there was a character out there whose story was worth telling. And I just found myself desperate to know it. Mm-hmm. And the idea of who is Luke Skywalker came up, the question of what if someone didn't really know that Luke was real, the idea of someone who would travel the galaxy fighting for justice and freedom, and the idea that someone might not even believe that was real. Like, well, what is that person's life like? And it just became a story that I knew I needed to uncover.
There may be, I doubt it, but for the sake of asking this question, let me set it up anyway. There may be somebody on the planet, maybe one person, who has never seen any iteration of Star Wars. If they haven't, will they get this movie?
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
There are quite a few people who have not seen Star Wars. And not just because they're younger, but because in some cases they live in countries where Star Wars was never released.
Right.
And granted, we all take it for granted in this country, and we assume it's sort of a birthright. You're born and you just understand who Darth Vader is.
Yeah.
But the fact is, that's not the case, and we knew that. So going in, we knew we had to make a movie that worked on its own terms. But if you look at even the first Star Wars movie, which of course was called Episode IV, that movie makes references to things that it never explains. It talks about the Clone Wars. It talks about the Senate. It talks about the Dark Times and all sorts of things that you just have to infer what the meaning is.
Yeah.
And George Lucas, among his many brilliant strokes in that film, he told a story where he didn't spoon-feed the audience every detail, and it made you fill in the blanks, and it made you believe there was a world beyond the borders of what you were watching.
Yeah. What has being able to shepherd this project done to your understanding, appreciation for, you fill in the blank, George Lucas?
I will tell you, he's a man I was grateful to at 11 years old. And I thought I could never be more grateful, for what he's done. Mm-hmm. Creating what he did and everything that we have done, of course, stands on the shoulders of what he's built. It's made me realize how unbelievably he got everything right on those first movies. Like, when you look at those movies and you think the characters, the heart, the comedy, the action, the plot, the design, the music, the scale, the scope, everything about that movie, any one of those things would have worked. And you'd be like, it's pretty, even now we'd be talking about it. But he did all of them, So I feel, looking at that movie, I feel real gratitude. I also am grateful for his confidence in me to do this, that he would say to me when I was first signed on to do it, you're going to do this movie, I'm going to step back, it's going to be your thing. I asked him at a certain point, do you want to see the movie early? He said, I want to see it when it's done, when it comes out. Like, he was just, I suppose, ready to sell his company as he did to Disney. But the fact that he would, and I knew him a little bit for a few years before this all happened, for him to trust me with this thing that is so important to so many is very meaningful.
You keep saying things that are on my list of things I want to talk about, so I'm just going to keep following
please.
You. So thank you for leading. I'm just following here. I'm always following J.J. Abrams.
Oh, stop.
So you mentioned music.
Have a smiley.
You are a music lover.
Yes,
I'm
sir.
A music lover. I say this, and you'll take my point. Mm. So when we saw the movie was coming out and you started pulling the team together, so we have these production meetings around here, and I get a chance to say, you know, who I would like to have on the show. It doesn't mean I'm going to get them. But in this film, these are the persons I'd like to get. At the top of my list of people that I wanted to talk to for this film was a guy who wasn't in the film, but he did the music for it. I wanted to talk to John Williams. And talk to me about John Williams.
Oh, I'm so happy that you're bringing this up. First of all, when Kathy Kennedy first proposed this collaboration, among the things that were discussed was that John Williams, and I asked her, would he be willing? She said, yeah, he already wants to do it.
Yeah.
So I came on board knowing John Williams was going to continue scoring the Star Wars movie. And it was one of the things I was looking forward to most throughout the entire experience. I mean, and there were so many moments of unreal joy in getting to work on this thing. Huge challenges at every turn. It wasn't just cakewalk, but it was like John Williams was sort of the carrot at the end of the stick. It was at the end of production, at the end of post-production. I get to work with John Williams. So I sat down and had a meeting with him, and I found out, first of all, that he could not, literally, as you know, could not be lovelier. Mm-hmm. He is...
Nicest guy in the world.
Nicest, and the most honestly modest person I've ever met. When you look at the effect that he's had on cinema, every movie he's done, watch almost any scene without the sound on and see what that scene does. Mm-hmm. It's a very different experience. A profound effect. You can't overstate the importance of his role in the movies he's worked on. And he doesn't speak like a man who has accomplished anything. He talks about his work in the most humble way. It is the most true and authentic and beautiful thing because it's not false modesty. He's not trying to make you... He is simply just this artist who just does this thing and claims almost no responsibility for it. And touches us. He writes music that is as moving and soulful and profound and important as any text, as any speech an actor could give. And watching him do his work was a gift. And I got to show him in half-hour chunks this movie, which scared the hell out of me because I was showing John Williams scenes from Star Wars movies he hadn't seen yet, which I couldn't understand, that I directed. And he would watch them, and he would ask these questions, and he would ask things like, he'd say, you know, in this moment here, he calls everyone baby. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if he gets to know you at all, you're Tavis baby. Mm-hmm. So he goes, he's like, JJ baby, you know, dare we use the Imperial March in this moment, you know? And he'll, like, referencing one of his themes he's done. I'm like, you know, yes, John, I think we dare. I think we must dare.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the greatest cues ever.
Right.
You know, he's like, oh, okay. And it's like he's almost like embarrassed to go back and almost revisit work he's done. And he sat and watched at one of the playbacks. He watched the movie. And he told me afterwards that it was the first time he had ever watched a Star Wars movie from beginning to end all the way through. Mm-hmm. But he just hasn't done that because he writes the music, he does his thing, and then he sort of moves on. I cannot thank the powers that be enough that I got to meet, let alone collaborate with John Williams.
If you were nervous to show half-hour chunks to John Williams, and I don't know how this worked, you tell me. I don't know if Disney, the studio, saw dailies or you showed it to them in chunks or what, but take me to that moment when you were in the room and you had to show your work to the Disney people.
Well, Kathy Kennedy and I went and showed the movie months and months ago to Bob Iger and Alan Horn and Alan Bergman. And so the five of us were in the room and we just, I talked quite a bit at the beginning because so much was missing, you know, not just visual effects, but big chunks of scenes and things that were just, you know, but I knew they needed to see the movie. And they had watched dailies, of course, and have been incredibly supportive. I can't say enough about them. But it was utterly terrifying, frankly, because I wanted it so much to be what I knew it could become, given time and visual effects and sound and all that stuff. But this was a very rough, very, very early thing with a lot of cards that would come up that would basically say, you know, this is where you're going to get emotional because this is what, you know, but like the scene wasn't there.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying. And I was writing notes. I was sitting in the back and I was just filling up a pad of literally, you know, 100, 200 notes of just things that I knew had to be fixed. And luckily their reaction was far more positive than mine was. And they we had a great short meeting afterwards, went over a couple things, but they never mandated anything. They never, it was never a corporate approach to making movies, which, to be honest with you, I didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah. But there was never a demand for something that would be about a toy or something that would be about selling it. It was always about, all right, well, if that's what you guys think. And I think having Kathy Kennedy there as a kind of protector was priceless.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to the film and what we're going to see and some of the personalities you had a chance to work with who are returning to the film, like Harrison Ford, et cetera.
Yes, sir.
But I want to ask it like sort of a business question here, I guess, or a branding question. Like, why take the risk? I teased you earlier about being sequel man. Mm. But why professionally take the risk to put something in your hands that an audience saw, whether it's Mission Impossible or Star Trek or Star Wars?
Right.
Just take me inside. I'm trying to get inside your head and heart about why even take. I guess everything is a risk in this business.
That's right.
But why take those kinds of risks? Are they calculated? Are they?
Well, they're certainly calculated in the moment the opportunity arises.
Right.
But you know, when Tom Cruise asked me if I would direct Mission Impossible 3, while it wasn't, you know, my dream to direct a sequel, it was my dream to direct a film.
Right.
And working with Tom Cruise, an actor I admire enormously, that opportunity doesn't come up every day. So for him to ask if I wanted to direct that movie, and it was a genre I loved, and it was based on a series that I really enjoyed as a kid, which in fact inspired me to create Alias, and then oddly it was Alias that got me the job on Mission. It was something that felt so right. And Katie at the time, my wife, said, you know, really, you want to direct a sequel? You know, and I said, yes, this is a Tom Cruise movie that gives me a chance, because what I loved was the idea of saying, well, who is Ethan Hunt, the main character? Mm-hmm. Who is he when he's in a relationship? Who is he when he's at home? What does that look like? And so I got excited about the story, and I thought, this is an amazing opportunity to get to direct a first movie and to do it with someone who is an extraordinary powerhouse and learn everything I've always wanted to learn and jump in and do it. On Star Trek, I'd never really liked Star Trek growing up. But I thought, there's probably a version that would be really fun and exciting for me.
Yeah.
And when am I ever going to get a chance to do a space adventure? So this is like an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
So I did that and loved the experience and the cast and crew. On Star Wars, like I said, I said no because I'd done those other movies. But then when I met with Kathy, and Steven Spielberg had been lobbying her to get to hire me for the movie, and he'd been lobbying me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sort of behind the scenes, working it. But the truth is, sitting with Kathy, it wasn't a strategic thing. It wasn't a calculated thing. It was an emotional thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I will say is that none of those movies that I've mentioned were ever jobs for me, meaning it was never a thought of, well, I can make a living doing this, or this is the opportunity. Mm-hmm. It was a chance to take a leap that was a little bit scary.
Yeah.
The Star Trek sequel less so because I had done that before, but I love the people so much, I had a very hard time saying no to working with them again.
Yeah.
But each of these movies were, on some level and some on many levels, passion projects, despite having numbers in the titles.
Yeah. You mentioned the word emotional a moment ago. Let me come back to Star Wars now,
yeah.
And I don't want to color this question any more than this. I want to give you a palette to paint on here.
All right.
When I think Star Wars, I think humanity.
Yes,
and there are any number of tentacles that come off of that.
Mm-hmm.
But a film at its best, I think, says something to us about our own shared humanity.
Yes.
I don't need to set you up any more than that. But tell me what we're going to see. What are we going to confront, learn, come to terms with about humanity?
This is why I love talking to you. I will say this, that the heart of Star Wars is the heart, meaning it's not just about action. It's not just about cool design or spaceships. It's about the heart of the characters. And anyone who knows and cares about Star Wars, I think, would agree with that. Yeah, there's great stuff to look at, and it's thrilling and it's fun, but it's only thrilling because you love the characters. And to me, it was always a story about family, whether related or not. Mm-hmm. It was Star Wars was always about discovery. It was always about alliances and loyalty. It was about friendship. And the fact that in Star Wars, you know, you kind of forget when you look at all the movies and you think, I am your father, and you think that Luke and Leia are brother and sister and all that. But the truth is, when you watch the first movie, you don't know who Luke's dad is, and you don't know that Leia's his sister. And it's all potential. It's all possibility. And for me, as an 11-year-old kid going to see Star Wars for the first time, my mind exploded because it was so sweet. It was so funny. It showed good in people. It dealt with evil. It dealt with good versus evil and darkness. And the idea of the Force, this thing that George created, is such a powerful idea. And you can look at it all different ways, but for me, the notion that we're all connected, mm-hmm. that somehow there's an energy that just connects all of us, it's not about religion. It's not a non-denominational approach. It's about life. Mm-hmm. And to me, that sense of humanity and of goodness and of finding a brother or a sister out in the world, it made me at 11 years old feel like, well, I hope that the world is full of this kind of possibility. Mm-hmm. I hope I can go out and cross paths with and become the deepest of friends with characters like this, people that make me laugh, mm-hmm. people that have... And it just, to me, the humanity of Star Wars was everything. Mm-hmm. And all the music and all the design and all the visual effects and all the stuff that was really, you know, great to look at and hear, it all was serving one thing, and it was the heart of the characters mm-hmm. in the movie. So for me, working with Larry Kasdan, who wrote Empire Strikes Back and he wrote Return of the Jedi, working on the script with him... And not just looking at a continuum of what's happened in the time that's passed and where are the characters that we know now, but being able to create new characters who have agency, who have their own sense of mm-hmm. right and wrong, but don't quite know where they are. And what they discover in this movie is they're in a Star Wars universe. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was what Kathy and I were first talking about that got me so excited. These new young people who realize... Oh, my God, look where I am.
But you also get a chance to work with some of the old heads. I say that lovingly. We know that Princess Leia is back in a sure. different form. I'll leave that where it is. Han Solo is back. Mm-hmm. Luke Skywalker is back. Mm-hmm. Working with these actors who launched this enterprise, how cool was that?
It was great. It was also a little unnerving. Like, to have Harrison Ford walk onto the set of the Millennium Falcon in costume.
Yeah.
You know, it falls into the... paralyzed, surreal, how do you handle this kind of, you know, category? So I had to suppress my fanboy nature because on the one hand, I want to go like, you know, I want to just slap whoever's next to me and go like, look who it is, what? On the other hand, that's not why I'm there.
Right.
I'm not hired to geek out. I'm there to hopefully tell a story and work with the actors. And it's not why Harrison's there. He's not there to be idolized. Yeah, He's there to collaborate, and he was, Carrie Fisher was, Mark Hamill was, Peter Mayhew, Anthony Daniels, everyone who's involved in this movie who had been there before could have been, could have made it difficult, not just for me, but for the younger actors who were coming in. They could have gotten in the way. They could have challenged, mm-hmm. but they didn't, to a person. They realized it's a generational tale. They realized this is a story that really is about this new young cast, these new characters. They were there not just to support, but to take the spotlight when it was required of them. It was like everyone on the crew, everyone on the new cast, but everyone in the original cast, everyone, came to this thing with this crazy inline passion to serve the story, to make the fans proud, to make new fans for Star Wars, and frankly, to continue in the spirit of what George did years ago.
He's the head of Bad Robot, and he's a bad man. And I don't need to convince you of that. You know his work. Star Wars, The Force Awakens, hits theaters in this country and around the world, I guess. J.J., so honored to have you on this program.
It's always an honor.
Congratulations in advance.
Thank you, my friend.
It's going to be a huge success.
Cheers.
Good to have you here.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The Star Wars franchise is the product of great storytelling, to be sure, but without its stellar soundtrack, it may never have reached such cosmic proportions. And so joining us now is the musical force behind The Force, John Williams. He has, of course, not only written the score for every installment of the Star Wars saga, a lifetime achievement in itself, but also for such Hollywood mega hits as Jaws, Superman, the Indiana Jones and Harry Potter movies, E.T., Jurassic Park, Saving Private Ryan, you get the point, and far too many more to mention. He's the winner of 5 Oscars, 17 Grammys, 2 Emmys, 3 Golden Globes, and again, far too many more awards to mention. Before we start our conversation with John Williams, a small sample of his iconic work. This and so much more that we don't even have time to mention, the AFI, the American Film Institute, has just announced that John Williams will be its first composer to be the recipient of the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award in June of 2016. So congratulations, my friend.
Thank you, Tavis.
I'm honored to have you back on this program.
Well, I'm happy to be here with you. I love being with you.
I love being with you.
Come back many times as you like.
Well, believe me. When you show up, magic happens, and so I'm glad to have you here. I mentioned the AFI tribute that's coming your way in just a few months into the new year. But the tributes are going to start a little early because J.J. Abrams was just here. I asked J.J. about what it was like to work with the iconic John Williams. And I want to play for you what J.J. Abrams had to say about working with John Williams.
It was one of the things I was looking forward to most throughout the entire experience. I mean, and there were so many moments of unreal joy in getting to work on this thing. Huge challenges at every turn. It wasn't just cakewalk, but it was like John Williams was sort of the carrot at the end of the stick. It was at the end of production, at the end of post-production, I get to work with John Williams. So I sat down, had a meeting with him, and I found out, first of all, that he could not, literally, as you know, could not be lovelier. Mm-hmm. He is...
nicest guy in the world.
Nicest and the most the most honestly modest person I've ever met. When you look at the effect that he's had on cinema, every movie he's done, watch almost any scene without the sound on and see what that scene does. Mm-hmm. It's a very different experience. A profound effect. You can't overstate the importance of his role in the movies he's worked on. And he doesn't speak like a man who has accomplished anything. He talks about his work in the most humble way. It is the most true and authentic and beautiful thing, because it's not false modesty. He's not trying to make you... He is simply just this artist who just does this thing and claims almost no responsibility for it and touches us. He writes music that is as moving and soulful and profound and important as any text, as any speech an actor could give.
I wanted to play that in advance of all these accolades that are going to come your way this big AFI tribute to see what J.J. Abrams thinks of you.
He's way too generous. I can do another half an hour what I think about him. You probably know that.
Yeah.
This is the greatest guy. He's a fabulous, direct, honest, wonderful artist with a beautiful family. No affectations or fussing about him. And he's a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker, as most people are learning more and more every day. Yeah. I'm happy to see him on a program like yours so people can hear his voice, hear the brilliant articulation that he has. He talks, you know, brilliantly in paragraphs and beautiful sentences.
Yeah.
And they will learn to know him as we who are fortunate enough to work with him do come to know him.
Well, the beauty of having you on
is that unlike JJ, you have been in every iteration of all seven of these adventures. What does it feel like on this seventh journey?
Well, it's weird, Tavis, because the first one was 1977.
That's right.
And so I don't know how many years ago. It's a long time. So I just tell people rather glibly I was 12 years old. So now I'm in 50.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
So to have one of the survivors, me and Larry Kasser, one of the writers from Hope Goes Way Back, I'm sure you know Larry. So we are, along with Harrison Ford and Carrie, you know, survivors from the original. But I may have told you this before, but when doing the first film in 1977, I had no idea there was going to be a second one. I don't think George Lucas certainly didn't confide in me and others working on the film. I didn't think there was another one coming and another one that kept coming. And I'm not entirely sure if he knew after the first one that there was going to be another one. I don't. You have to ask George about that because he's been very... But he went on and wrote with his little yellow pad, wrote the next film in longhand, the way he's done this. And what has happened is that we're here talking 30-plus years later about something that has become phenomenal in a profound way, worldwide audiences, maybe in the billions. I'm not even sure what it is, which transcends in some way the appeal of a film. It is reaching some good and bad force and evil kind of a mythological almost reduction, if you'd like to say, of something that turns it awakens something in our collective memories in some profound way. It looked to me like a children's film. It was going to play Saturday afternoon, have a couple of good weeks in the theater, and be gone.
Not exactly.
Yeah. And for reasons that are difficult to analyze, Joseph Campbell, tried to explain it to all of us after the fact. Did a pretty good job. So I'm just happy to have been able to continue working on it and have the fun of adding to a glossary of musical themes, picture after picture, which is, I think, something unique in film music history.
That was beautifully put, so I want to pick up on that phrase, adding to a glossary of musical themes, wonderfully put. What's the challenge of doing that, adding to that glossary of musical themes, when, again, I understand that you didn't know there's going to be a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh film, and you score them one film at a time.
Right.
But when you get to the third or the fourth and you're looking back, and now you're smart enough to know that there may be another one going forward, musically, artistically, how does that impact how you keep that glossary growing?
Well, I would hope any composer would or writer would, if you're adding something, or that you can graft something onto the corpus of what you originally had and not have it be a foreign element, a foreign substance that won't live with the other tissue, if I can put it that way. And a certain melodic style, a certain modality in the harmonies and so on that we recognize as being, if not Star Wars exactly, but heroic in some kind of cinematic way, maybe is a way to put it. And a wonderful opportunity to do that. I mean, the Darth Vader theme was not in the first film. I had no idea that was going to happen, that we would get to know Darth Vader and his costume. And I have to say somewhere along this conversation, Davis, that I feel privileged, you know, lucky in the first place to have the assignment, which Steven Spielberg was the one who said to George Lucas, you know, I hired this guy. He wasn't exactly a kid even then. And to be still around, be able to do this, I feel very, very lucky and very fortunate, I must say.
They've been blessed to have you too, though.
Well, it's been fun. You know, we had the greatest orchestra. I think I told you a few moments ago. We usually had done the scores with the London Symphony, but we couldn't go to London for the kind of time that JJ needed. So we did it here with our studio orchestra. And Gustavo Dudamel is a great genius conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. I said, come down to the session one day. And he came down. And I said to the orchestra from the podium after lunch, I feel a little bit tired this afternoon. I've engaged a young gentleman to come in and substitute for me for a couple of hours.
And it was Dudamel.
Yeah, it was Dudamel. And I said, when he gets to the podium, please be courteous to him. He's a very talented young man. So the orchestra, of course, was so excited.
Yeah.
And I think played a little better for him than they did for me. They were all sitting up like this, you know. So he's become part of it, you know.
Yeah.
So
now Dudamel is part of Star Wars.
Yes, he is in a way. He had his little son Martin there, Martin.
Yeah.
And they had a marvelous time. But I mention it because the fun of having the orchestra One of these kind of invitations you get from every visitor you have here. Mm. One of these days you'll come and visit the sessions because they're really fun.
Yeah.
A 90-piece symphony orchestra playing away, and it's like a dream.
I will take you up on that one day. I must tell you, though, I've been fortunate to be in some great photos, I think, in my career, but none greater than the one that sits in my office. I have a great photo of John Williams, Gustavo Dudamel, and myself. In that photo, we spent some time at the Academy talking about music scoring and film, and I was just honored to be there with you and Dudamel.
Well, I have the picture, and I treasure it also, truly. It's right. Exactly where it's my living room. Yeah. He's 35 years old, which is, I even said to the orchestra, the theme of Star Wars that is older than Gustavo.
I hadn't thought about that.
It's a fact, written before he was born. Of course, he knew it very well. But we've had a marvelous time with these things.
Yeah. When JJ is showing you, the audience now knows that JJ showed you the new film, Star Wars, The Force Awakens. He showed it to you in half-hour chunks, he basically said.
Right.
I'm just trying to get inside your process, your head. How do you score a film? How do you go to work when you're seeing a project in half-hour chunks?
Well, it's difficult that way, Thomas, really, because I'll tell you very quickly why. If I could write the finale first of the end and then extract things from the finale, so what you hear in the finale that's mature is suggested in the first reel.
So there's a theme all the way.
And it becomes more of a theme. Four notes in the first reel, six notes in the third reel, 12 notes.
You're
getting it.
And
finally, we get to the finale and you got all 24 notes.
Okay.
I know what that is. So it's a process of building.
Uh-huh.
With JJ, who was brilliant because he will keep changing the picture, but he knows what he shot. We don't know what he shot. He remembers it, but I only know what he shows me.
Right.
So we did the first two or three reels, and because of this process, I had to go back and rework some of it as we went through.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you that I'm one of the writers that you'll meet that really does not mind rewrites. I mean, I don't know what writer Hemingway said, the art of rewriting is the art of rewriting. You make your prose, you look at it next week, you can improve it every time you look at it, if you get a little objectivity given away from it. So it took us longer to score the film. We started in June, and now you and I are talking at the end of the year, sporadically. But I really think in the end, I have to think it gave me an opportunity to work some things and maybe do a better job.
Mm-hmm.
Because in film business, everything is compressed, because of budgets. You've got to do this in 6 weeks or 8 weeks, 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you may need 12 to do it as the way you want to do it or have a chance to. So it worked very much in my favor.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept coming back. The orchestra was so happy. And J.J. is... He's a dream. He talks about my being modest, but I think we can turn it around on him.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
He really is a spectacular guy.
So since none of us, most of us at least, haven't seen the film as yet, I'm going to ask a question, but I'm in the dark asking this. What is there in this film that JJ has done that's different from the other stuff that gave you something musically to play with? Does that make sense?
It makes.
I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I don't know what I'm asking. But
no, it makes total sense. I'll get quickly to it. But I just have to say that George Lucas has given us something like Charles Dickens. He invented Yoda. He invented Darth Vader. The characters that are part of the culture worldwide. Colossal achievement, and just in writing terms of what may the Force be with you.
Sure.
Any writer would kill for that.
Exactly.
JJ has taken the film. We talked about grafting on in the glossary of works and so on. It's Star Wars. It is Star Wars. It is George Lucas. But J.J. is one of the writers of the film, along with Larry Kasdan.
With Kasdan.
Another gentleman, name I will get in a second. And it's witty.
Mm-hmm.
It's young. The two principals, Stacey and John, are fabulous. And they're both in their early 20s, something like this. And I don't think they're experienced, but they are. Incredible. I don't want to be doing a commercial for the film, but they're going to fall in love with these kids. They really did a fabulous, fabulous job. So JJ has brought, I can say, youth to it, wit to it, energy to it, a freshness to it in his casting and his writing that I think people will immediately recognize as being, borrow the word again, being an energy to revitalize and revivify this thing the way that he's done. I maybe sound like I'm quite in love with it. People will see it and make their own judgment. You know, it's what it is. It's an entertainment film.
How does that youth and how does that energy? Because we are meeting new characters here.
Right.
So how does that youth? How does that energy? The direction that JJ's taking the story, open up opportunities for you musically to give us a score that is
Well, and the seventh one.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, there are themes for the new characters, for Daisy's character, which is, she's called, senior moment. It's Daisy's character, John's character, also there's a character called Poe. There is I think JJ referred to this, the Resistance. The Resistance is the radical group that wants to bring the Jedi back to power.
Right.
There's a strong, hopefully strong, march theme. Mm-hmm. That is new to them. So there's a lot of new material. Mm-hmm. So there are new themes. Rey is the girl's character, so the mm-hmm. audience will soon know. And interspersed with these are one of the original themes, the Force theme, which I won't attempt to sing, but I think people will recognize. Mm-hmm. Princess Leia's theme is in because Carrie comes back as Princess Leia, having grown her in the years. And Harrison's character of Han has mm-hmm. One thing that JJ was right in your interview with him about it is, when I had to quote myself from 30 years ago, I felt a little uncomfortable. It seemed
I love the way he described that. When you said, dare we? I was like, we dare. Yes, we dare.
Yeah, he did say, JJ, we really want to do this. Oh, you have to do it. We see Princess Leia, you got to play her theme.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, dear, who was that guy that wrote the theme? I don't even know who wore that person. Shred all that skin. But it's right.
Yeah.
I think the familiarity and the friendliness, if you like, of the thematic identification with the characters is the right thing to do. I mean, it's not something I think you do in contemporary movies very much. You wouldn't do that in the style of the contemporary. It's more like opera, since this character comes and he's got a theme. And this one's but it started that way for whatever reason, I don't know, with George Lucas. It just seemed to be the right approach. So I've just continued doing that, and the characters have new themes.
It's one thing for me and for all those who are going to see the film and for those who are going to be giving tributes to you at this AFI event next year. It's one thing for us to try to put into our own words what we think of the life and legacy, thankfully ongoing, of one John Williams. But where Star Wars specifically is concerned, how do you situate that in your corpus, in your body of work? How do you situate Star Wars 7 films in?
Well, the Star Wars films, 7 of them, I don't know how many films I've done, Tavis, maybe 100. I don't know. Mm-hmm. A lot of them not really memorable and so on, as we all have done. It is probably the most popular music that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And people will ask me, what's your favorite score and this and that. And I've done concertos and symphonies and other things that are some good, some not so good. Some are played and many are rightfully forgotten. But I think, I don't know, I think we're all the same in this sense that you look at your work or listen to your work and it's like children. You have 3 children. You love them, and they're beautiful. But there's something you wish this could have been better here, and that maybe as parents, we don't want to reflect that to the children. But the sense is, whatever we do, it can always be better.
Always
be better. Yeah. So I'm a composer of music, and I look at Mozart, and I look at Beethoven and Bach, the greatest organizers of sound that we've ever had, and. You need to be humble. Mm-hmm. The shoulders that we stand on are so great.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's in every endeavor that we do, broadcast.
To your point, you've done stuff that obviously is the soundtrack of our lives. I mean, we just played a sampling of your work. But you hear certain music themes, certain movie themes, and it's John Williams. I mean, you literally are, movie-wise, you are the soundtrack of our lives. So much of your stuff is obviously well-known. To your point, some stuff maybe not as well-known. But how do you know? Is there something inside of you? How do you know when you get it right? What's that? Do you know when you get it right?
Very, very rarely. You hope that you've gotten 90% of it or as close to it as you can. But at least with me, and I think with most writers of any kind, you really don't say eureka. This is it.
Yeah.
It's working this, come back the next week and reshape it and do it like a skull, keep honing away at it. I'm not so brilliant that I can sit down and write a melody or a theme or a whole scene or a whole work as Mozart might have done, we're told, dashing it off like a letter and the grammar's perfect.
Yeah.
it's very, writing music, at least what I, well, it's very, very hard work. And for orchestra particularly, you know, you have, it's a labor-intensive thing. I have to be in a room alone all the time because that's the way, that's the life that it is. And
it's hard work and it's lonely work.
It's hard work, it's lonely work, it's labor-intensive. I still use a pencil and paper. I don't have a computer anymore.
The old school.
The old school. I've been so busy, fortunately, that I haven't been able to go back and retool. Because when I was studying music, there were no computers.
Yeah, we
didn't have it.
Are you one of those composers or just artists who has a hard time letting go, or when it's time to let it go, you readily give it up?
Time to let it go, I let it go.
Yeah.
J.J. said, I think in his interview, I don't know if your public will hear it, that I have not looked at the Star Wars films, and that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And I haven't, when I'm finished with a film, I've been living with it, we've been dubbing it, recording to it, and so on, and you're done, you walk out of the studio, it's finished.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have an impulse to go to the theater and look at it maybe some people find that weird, or listen to recordings of my music very, very rarely. I'm not particularly proud of that, I have to say.
Yeah.
But it's also part of the fact that I finished Star Wars now, and I'm already working on Spielberg's new film, and I don't want to listen to music or see films because I want to get...
I get that. Yeah. You're a genius. And I'm always honored to have you on this program.
Thank you so much.
As I mentioned, the AFI is going to honor John Williams, the first composer to receive the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award in the summer, June to be exact, of 2016. And so maybe I'll have that as another excuse to get him back on the program, hint, hint, so we can continue this conversation. For now, though, Star Wars, The Force Awakens arrives at a theater near you, as if you didn't know that. and so you're going to hear the fine work of John Williams all over the score. John Williams, I love you and I'm honored to have you on.
And to you. Same
Thank you,
to
my
you.
Friend. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.